With a weight up to 80 pounds and a length up to 6 feet, the pallid sturgeon is one of the largest freshwater fish species in North America. It can also live up to 50 years or more. But even though pallid sturgeon come from a genetic line going back tens of millions of years, it's been decades since there's been documentation of the large fish successfully producing young that survive into adulthood on the upper Missouri River Basin. The pallid sturgeon was placed on the endangered species list 25 years ago. A new paper published last week in the journal Fisheries explains why pallid sturgeon in the Missouri have been declining. The lead author on the paper is Dr. Christopher Guy, assistant unit leader with the USGS Montana Cooperative Fishery Unit and professor at Montana State University. He joins us on the line from Bozeman. And Chris, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Thanks, Carl. Thanks for having me on.
Well, to begin with, I'd like to get a little bit of a description, a little bit of background on the pallid sturgeon. What does it look like?
Well, it's really a prehistoric-looking fish. It's well designed for the turbid Missouri River. It has a kind of a spade-type snout, very small eyes. It has very sharp scutes down the side of the body, and so it's well designed for that turbid environment with a lot of shifting sand substrate and things like that. Its rostrum, or that spade snout I was talking about earlier, has some barbels that extend off of it, and it's very efficient in finding prey in what might be considered a pitch black environment at the bottom of the muddy Missouri River.
What sort of prey does the pallid sturgeon like?
Well, that's what's interesting. The pallid sturgeon, when they're young, probably up to 4 or 5 years old, feed mostly on invertebrates. We call them midges. And as it gets older, it switches to fish species. And some of the work we've done up above Fort Peck in the Missouri River found that they feed mostly on sicklefin and sturgeon chub, which is also a species of conservation interest certainly in the lower basin. But as we've studied the sturgeon more, the pallid sturgeon more, we find that they're opportunistic. They'll feed on a lot of variety of different species of fish. What's interesting is the really close cousin, the shovelnose sturgeon that lives in the Missouri as well, even as they get older, they still feed on invertebrates, those midge larvae. And so that's kind of how the two species partition the food resources as they get older.
Now, how does the shovel-nose sturgeon compare to the pallid sturgeon? It's quite a bit smaller, correct?
Yeah, it tends to be quite a bit smaller, might not live as long, and certainly seems to be, in terms of habitat requirements, a bit different than the pallid sturgeon, and that's why the shovel-nose sturgeon is what we would call recruiting to the population still. They live in parts of the river and the tributaries that are further away from this zone that I think we're going to talk about in a little bit, mm-hmm. the headwaters of the reservoirs. And so, for example, again, up in Montana, above Fort Peck, the shovelnose sturgeon will be found, you know, hundreds of miles upstream from the reservoir, whereas the pallid likes to be in a little bit different habitat, more with a shifting sand type habitat, and the shovelnose sturgeon will use gravel, cobble type habitat.
You described the fish, I think you used the term prehistoric, and I've heard the pallid sturgeon called a living fossil or even a living dinosaur. Are those accurate descriptions, terms for the fish?
Well, yes. Yeah, as best we know from the fossil records, it looks like the Scaphorhynchus species coexisted with dinosaurs during the Cretaceous period in that Mesozoic area, probably about 70 million years ago. There is some fossil record indicating that.
Now, when we talk about the habitat for the pallid sturgeon, what is the preferred habitat? What do they need to be able to spawn, particularly?
Well, some just recent work is coming out on that, and it looks like it's gravel patches, so probably gravel that maybe the size of your fist all the way up to even bigger pieces that are in patches of a sand habitat. So kind of this mosaic, if you will, of habitat where you have gravel and sand And it looks like they're picking those gravel patches. And this is important because when the fish spawns, their eggs are adhesive, and they stick onto that gravel before they hatch. If they were to stick on the sand, then they would roll with that sand because the sand in the Missouri tends to kind of shift and move a little bit because of the velocity at the bottom of the river.
And when the pallid sturgeon spawn, they're quite a bit old, aren't they?
Yeah, so we're learning quite a bit about that as well. And it looks like in the lower Missouri River, and when I talk about the lower Missouri River, I'm talking about below the last dam, Gavin's Point Dam, it looks like females are probably anywhere around 9 to 10 years old before they start to spawn. And in the upper basin here, so that's up in North Dakota and Montana, it looks like they might even be around 18 before they become sexually mature. Males tend to be a little bit younger when they become sexually mature, and maybe 5 to 7 in the lower basin. And again, it's around probably 10 to 15, so quite a bit different in the upper basin.
So what does that mean for the endangered nature of the pallid sturgeon? I mean, how does that they don't spawn until they're quite mature? What does that mean for the fish's survival?
Well, in terms of survival and relative to the factors that we looked at, it's not as important, but it does become very important if we talk about exploitation or something like that. Species that typically take a long time to become sexually mature, whether they're marine or freshwater species, are highly vulnerable to exploitation. But we know that that's been, there's no exploitation for pallid sturgeon throughout its range. But I guess getting back to your question specifically is that it does take a while for us to, when we're studying the species, for us to see events. For example, we stocked these pallid sturgeon, a group of pallid sturgeon in 1997, and it's taken us a while to see what the contribution of those fish are to the population. So in terms of conducting research and trying to figure out what's going on, it takes a while.
You're listening to Dakota Midday from South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and we're talking with Christopher Guy of the USGS Montana Cooperative Fishery Unit. He's also a professor at Montana State University, and he was the lead author on a paper published last week in the journal Fisheries explaining why pallid sturgeon in the Missouri have been declining. And let's talk about the research. What is it that you discovered about the decline of the pallid sturgeon in the Missouri?
Well, since it was listed in 1990, a lot of people have been working on pallid sturgeon. We quickly realized the species has no recruitment, that is, zero survival of their young. And I'm going to talk specifically about the upper basin again, above Gavin's Point Dam, and particularly above Lake Sakakawea and into the river above Fort Peck, Montana. And zero recruitment, that is, none of their young have survived. And so it took a series of experiments and, kind of this iteration of work to kind of figure out why that was the case. A lot of people had kind of speculated that it had something to do with the fragmentation of the river by the dams. But the first thing we needed to figure out is, were the fish spawning that were out there? And if they were spawning, where? We found that out. And then some key research done by another USGS scientist, Patrick Broughton, discovered that they need a lot of river for the young to drift. So the eggs are adhesive. They adhere to cobble gravel substrate, and then in a few days they hatch. And once they hatch, they drift in the river, basically at the whims of the current, and they're a little bit negatively buoyant, so they drift near the bottom of the river. They're feeding on this yolk sac, and we call them proto-larvae, or in the paper we call it a free embryo, same thing. And so they're feeding on this yolk sac as they're drifting down the river. And he discovered that they need hundreds of miles to drift in that stage before they settle to the bottom and start to look like a sturgeon and swim around. Once we had that information, then we knew that something was going on in the reservoirs, because where they were spawning and the distance to the headwaters of those reservoirs was not far enough. So then we started looking in the headwaters of the reservoir, and we found that at the bottom, you know, in this transition zone, it's where the river starts to slow down, the sediment load drops out, and it starts to look like a lake. And right there where that sediment drops out is where the oxygen on the bottom is zero. And that's a function of microbial activity on all the fine particulate organic matter. All that material that makes the river look muddy starts to settle out. And as you know from these reservoirs, as you get down by the dam, they're crystal clear. Well, all that material had to settle out. And where that's settling out just happens to be where those sturgeon larvae settle out.
So this is essentially creating these oxygen-depleted dead zones between the dams?
Yep, and this occurs in that upper reach, and it's a really kind of well-defined reach. And it's been described before, but as I said, we in terms of hypothesize that there's these dead zones in these transition zones, but we made the link between the sturgeon, where they're spawning, how far they're drifting, and exactly what habitat they're going into.
So how significant is this study's conclusion?
Well, I mean, we think it's very significant because we have identified the mechanism. You know, the species has been listed, for 25 years, if I did my math right, and everybody's been kind of looking for the mechanism of why they're not recruiting. And we feel like, you know, this is the mechanism. And if we're serious about recovery of this species, as outlined in the recovery plan by the Fish and Wildlife Service, then something's got to be done. And I would like to mention that the agencies, the Corps of Engineers and Fish and Wildlife Service, are currently trying to develop working on models to develop different flow regimes out of Fort Peck, different water levels in Sakakawea, to see if they can get the drift distance within the defined bookends, I guess, if you will, in the current master manual that the Corps of Engineers operates under.
Along with trying to increase the drift distance, is there a way to, get more oxygen into these dead zones?
That's been discussed, and again, I got to be careful here because I present the science, mm-hmm. but these areas are very large, and I think I'm trying to do oxygen injection or aerators or something like that is probably going to be very difficult. You know the size, living in South Dakota, you know the size of these reservoirs. They're right. Massive, and those transition zones up there are very big.
Now, do researchers know when the pallid sturgeon began to decline in the Missouri? Was it, did this happen after the dams then?
That's a great question, and one that's very difficult to answer, because pre-dam data for the pallid sturgeon is basically, or I guess I should say, reliable pre-dam data for the sturgeon is non-existent. There's some anecdotal data on where an adult pallid sturgeon was caught by an angler or a commercial fisherman and things like that, but we don't have reliable data on how many were in there. But we do know, you know, from all the fisheries biologists that are working on this problem, that if you have no survival, then you have a problem, right? So the population growth is declining for pallid sturgeon in these inter-reservoir reaches.
So with these the stocked sturgeon, are they able to survive in the river?
Yeah, and so the stocked sturgeon, they're usually stocked at age one or age two, and they do very well in the river. So that also helped us kind of narrow the focus of where the problem was. And so for example, those fish that were stocked in 1997, we have some of those fish above Fort Peck Reservoir. The males are now becoming sexually mature. They look like a pallid sturgeon, and a wild pallid sturgeon. They behave like a wild pallid sturgeon because we've done a lot of work on them, seeing how much in terms of their movement patterns, their diet and habitat use looks like a wild pallid sturgeon. So they are doing great. So we know that from that the bottleneck was somewhere at an age younger than age one, because once we stock the fish in, they do great. And that's a good thing, right? Mm-hmm. Because that has bought us some time, if you want to think of it like that. And that was one of the first things that once the species was listed was, okay, let's figure out how to propagate this species. Let's get some in the river to buy us some time. And there's been great work done on that and paying very close attention to the genetic diversity. So that's been a real success story of this program.
Where is the pallid sturgeon found? Is it found elsewhere other than the Missouri River and the Mississippi?
Mostly Missouri and Mississippi, and, you know, for example, they will use the lower end of the Platte River and some of the lower end of the big tributaries like the Kansas and some of the tributaries on the Mississippi, but mostly main stem Missouri River and Mississippi River.
There was news recently that they found two larval pallid sturgeon found in the lower Missouri River, I think two. Does this suggest that the fish are naturally reproducing then, or is this encouraging news?
Yeah, this is really encouraging news because, again, you think about how difficult this species is to study and to work in the Missouri River. So we're using sampling gear in a turbid large river. You know, it's basically we're blindfolded in terms of trying to figure out where to sample the fish. These larvae are just a few millimeters long, and you might be sampling hundreds of thousands of cubic meters of water that, and so you're basically looking for a needle in a haystack. And they knew in the lower basin that the sturgeon were spawning because they would find a female that was full of eggs, and then they would recapture her, and her eggs would be gone. But they didn't know if the spawning was successful. And so by capturing these larvae in the lower Missouri, they know that the spawning is successful. That is, the eggs are fertilized and the eggs are hatching. So that's a really significant finding because it has been also kind of a black box down there in terms of what's going on.
Is that what's because they're so low that makes it difficult to study them at those depths?
Yeah, that they're near the bottom, and then their low density just relative to the volume of water makes sampling and finding them very difficult.
Well, what happens next? You know, this has been published. Then what happens with this research, and what will you be doing next?
Well, we're going to continue to look at the dead zone. There's some questions we have about how big is it, and what does it do when the reservoirs go up and down? And our hypothesis is it just moves water level of the reservoirs. So we need to make some more measurements to try and figure out how big it is, what are the dynamics in terms of spatial and temporal variation. And we really hope that, as we stated in the paper, that policymakers, you know, ecologists, engineers, all get together and start thinking creatively about how we can manage the rivers maybe a little differently than we've been thinking about, because in our paper we said most of the focus has been on how much water we need to let out of the dam, you know, to create what we would call a natural hydrograph. And we're saying that might be important, but don't forget about what's going on in the upper end of the reservoirs. And so trying to get creative about how we can manage these reservoirs in such a way that that we can benefit the species and as well maintain the benefits to society.
All right. Chris, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us on Dakota Midday and sharing the results of your study.
Thanks, Carl, and thanks for the interest in our science.